Hello and welcome to our final election series podcast. My name is Mary Spowich and I'm joined today by my colleague at Strathclyde, Dr. Matthew Hannan, who is a senior lecturer in the Hunter Centre for Entrepreneurship. But most importantly for our podcast today, he also has a podcast called Local Zero. And he's joined us today to talk a bit about the climate change related policies that the parties are proposing in their manifestos. So, welcome, Matt. Could you tell
Thank
us a
you.
little bit about your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. So, the Local Zero podcast, it's something we established in the run-up to COP26. And colleagues and I, Becky Ford, Fraser Stewart, we wanted to get together and talk a bit about what we can do individually and as communities about tackling climate change. So it's really about informing listeners about what they can do to make a difference. And of course, in the lead up to COP26, most of the discussion will be about, what governments and their commitments are at an international and national level. But, it begins and ends with us in terms of the actions we take and who we vote for. And of course, we'll talk a bit more about that today. But we thought no better time to set up a pod than this.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. And I actually I'm going to appear on your
You
podcast as a
are.
guest. So in an episode published later this week. So look out for that, and
Firstly.
we'll put out the link to the podcast in the description of our podcast so that listeners can see where to find that. So you've talked about a lot of different issues that we're going to chat about today in the podcast. We've been doing a lot of work to look at the different policies that the parties are proposing on, our areas of speciality, which are tax, spend, social security, and economic recovery and jobs. But when you hear people talk about, having a greener recovery, recovering in a more green way, what do you think generally people are meaning when they talk about that?
I think they mean two things, and often they don't know they mean two things. So the first is to recover from where we are now to where we were. And when they say that, they typically mean in terms of things like GDP, productivity, unemployment, and all the various things that the Fraser Philander will cover off and are expert on. But that's not enough, okay, to get to where we were before COVID struck in February, March 2020. That wasn't green. And actually, if we start to use the terminology of a just transition, which for the listeners who may or may not know, a just transition is delivering on net zero, but doing it in a socially equitable way. In a kind of shorthand, it's where we leave no one behind and everybody benefits. To achieve that goal, we really need to fundamentally change the structure of our economy. So it's not just about bouncing back. It is about then taking a new route forward and recalibrating the machinery of our economy. So we've a green recovery is actually recovery is almost the wrong term. It should be a green transition or a green transformation, because we can't go back to March 2020. And you know what? Even if we could, I think so much has happened in the interim that it would be difficult anyway, in terms of what has become apparent in terms of what we can and can't do, things like working from home and digitalization, and also what I think we value as consumers and citizens. I think people have started to unearth things that maybe matter to them more.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It'll be interesting to see how many of the things that have changed in our economy over the period of the pandemic, such as greater working from home, but also whether we the sort of value that we place on different types of work, such as social care and other key workers, and whether those things sort of persist into the post-COVID economy and into the recovery, as I think a lot of people will hope, and has certainly been reflected in a lot of the manifestos as well. So coming to the manifesto specifically then, what do you make of the policies that are in the manifestos to tackle climate change and I suppose change your economy in the way that you're suggesting we need to?
Okay, so I mean, this is an interesting time to release a manifesto, not least for the reasons around COVID, but of course, net zero. So green recovery is the watch term. I had a look through the manifestos of the five. I don't want to say big parties in case I disgruntle any listeners, but the more sort of established and longer run parties. So SNP, Conservative, Labour, Green and Lib Dem. I think if I can summarise very briefly about where we're at, I think all of the parties bar one probably get that a net zero transformation is necessary, and actually action needs to be taken today and for the duration of the next Scottish Parliament. And that isn't just about green measures, but it's also about socially just measures. I think the one party that maybe didn't deliver on that, the Conservatives, I think just objectively moving through the manifestos, their green and socially just kind of credentials, as it were, are just not as strong as the other parties. But it's not to say that there isn't stuff in there that they were sort of promoting. You know, we've got questions around even whether it's things like sort of land use, new national park with Galloway. I think there was reference there also to promoting cleaner seas and circular economy. If I'm right in saying, there's also reference there to electric vehicle charging. So, you know, there is, you know, good stuff in there. It's not to say that they have completely ignored what it, you know, a net zero transition will encompass. I think looking at the other parties, there's very little to differentiate them actually. And I was quite happy with that. I mean, that's good, right? That's if you're looking at this from a net zero just transition perspective, it is positive that there seems to be such strong cross-party support for various measures. So energy efficiency in the home place, tick. They're all, you know, SNP, Lib Dem, Conservatives as well were pushing for this, Labour too. We've also seen, what I thought was really interesting to see this, a push on, again, not so much the Conservative Party here, but the others looking at active transport and sort of 15 or 20 minute towns or cities. So again, that means that, you know, everything you really need, including the workplace, is 15 or 20 minutes away. And that is really about encouraging work and life proximity and supporting active active travel. Public ownership of certain services, in particular transport, was very popular as well. Labour references, Greens too, SNP, Lib Dems, I believe too. And that's interesting again, because I think that speaks of how the green agenda, which again, they big promotion there of public transport, can actually be tied into other agenda and other political ideology around, you know, market or state. I could go on here, but the what was good to see is there was lots of green and lots of socially equitable policies, particularly on the latter bit, I think, particularly from Labour, actually. Which probably, if I had to split them apart, maybe Labour wasn't quite up there with the, you know, the Greens and SNP on green policies, but there seemed to be a strong kind of basis and foundation around sort of more left-wing and socially just policies, which were written through their manifesto.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of our manifesto analysis has commented on how similar, how much consensus there is, I suppose, between the manifestos. And there are differences, but they are mostly at the margins. And we picked up in our article on economic recovery, which was obviously quite linked to the policies that the parties were talking about in terms of stimulating a green recovery or a transition in the economy. That you did have that difference in terms of transition between the parties, with maybe the Greens at one end and the Conservatives at the other. In terms of transition of away from oil and gas, for example.
And I think the Greens were one of the few parties that was really happy to come out and say, we will ban stuff, like, you know, we will. But actually, you know, you go, and I included, you know, fossil fuel boilers by 2025. That's in, you know, off gas grid buildings, sales of new petrol diesel cars by 2026. The thing is, this isn't what people would say, term kind of crazy policies. I think often the Greens were framed as very radical. Actually, this is stuff that the Climate Change Committee is sort of pushing there or thereabouts. And this is going mainstream now. I was surprised that I didn't see some of the other parties come out. I think the SNP had one policy there around banning fossil fuel buses by 2023. But, you know, the Greens were much more radical. Your point about oil and gas was interesting. And the, you know, transition away from oil and gas and the kind of oil and gas sort of sector deal and transition deal there, which UK government has supported, you know, often termed the North Sea transition deal. That's something the Conservatives were very keen to support. I think there's a lot of good things we can take from that is the idea that you can't simply kill an industry without offering a route forward. And that, whilst, you know, I would stand by my point around the Conservatives manifesto not being as strong on green credentials, I think we do have to take what they're saying about North Sea transition deal seriously, because and you know as well as I do how many jobs from the oil and gas industry are centered in Scotland. Oil and Gas UK pointing about 39% of UK oil and gas jobs, which is roughly, if you include direct, indirect, induced, about 100,000, give or take. So you can't just say to those 100,000 people, tough luck. You have to put something in place. And if we don't do that, I think we'll lose hearts and minds. And that's absolutely not the stance we can take.
Yeah, absolutely. The transition is really important. And as you know as well as I, there's a lot of obviously oil and gas companies who are part of the transition in terms of to different energy sources. And, you know, there is an opportunity there to reskill people. And, you know, the Northeast has been through a pretty tumultuous 5 or 6 years with the oil price downturn in 2015. We saw a big impact on the Scottish economy and supply chains then. And there seems to be a disproportionate impact when you look at things like payroll data on the Northeast. So it seems to have sort of exacerbated those issues. So it is certainly the case that we cannot just say to that industry, stop, you know.
No, and I think
to be transitioned.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, again, this was sort of ripped through many of the other manifestos around training and skills. It certainly wasn't just Conservatives saying this. I think it was just they were explicitly talking about this sector as one that was in need of, I don't want to say special treatment, because it shouldn't be special treatment. It should be all sectors that are going to be directly hurt by this should be supported to transition. But, you know, the SNP looking to invest about £500 million in new jobs to reskill people over the course of the parliament, and Labour looking at guaranteed jobs and training opportunities. So skills and training really were at the sort of front and centre of these manifestos.
Yeah, absolutely. And we covered that in our brief as well, in terms of the training, different sorts of ways of doing it, but, you know, extending the young person's guarantee to those who work in fossil fuel related industries was a proposal of the Greens, and there was different sort of training bonds and amounts for training, whether it's an annual amount or grants to reskill and change careers. So you can see it was a theme for all of the parties, just in slightly different ways, to help people retrain, whether that's because of COVID and the change in our structure of our economy because of that, or whether it's to do with transitioning to net zero. So yeah, definitely a big focus on that. Were there any measures that you thought you were particularly surprised or were particularly sort of innovative, or were there other areas that you thought, you know, that really need to be dealt with, but are so difficult that they kind of got ignored, I suppose?
It's an interesting question. So maybe an area of surprise in the context of net zero was the Conservatives' focus on road building. Okay, so and that was a great surprise. So the two kind of policies that stuck out for me was to expand the M8 to 3 lanes, to upgrade the whole A1 to dual carriageway. So, you know, this is, and I think often, and it, not just Conservatives, but other parties, other countries hide behind this is a policy and say, well, actually, you know, it'll be EVs driving these, and that's okay. I think there are massive benefits to reducing our reliance on cars, active travel, health. If you get rid of the car, you create space that was otherwise reserved for your cars to park, both at home and in the city. So this isn't very net zero. And actually, it isn't very just either, because people who can afford to own and run their own vehicles, often are not the most vulnerable or poorest of society. So that was a shame to see that, because that really is very much status quo. An area I think was lacking in focus, and I did have to do a bit of homework here to check what was in terms of devolved and reserve power, agriculture and diet and food. I was really surprised to see so little in there. So agriculture accounts for roughly 18% of, so food and diet, around 80% of our carbon footprint. So, with that, the question is, well, how are you going to decarbonize that? So part of the supply chain will be decarbonized by things like transport. So if you've electrified all your HGVs and LGVs or your car, then that deals with that to some extent. And actually, the Committee on Climate Change's progress report on focused specifically on Scotland pointed to issues around agriculture and wanted to see more. And this was before the manifestos, wanted to see more in 2019 around low carbon farming practices, strong regulation to ensure this was the case. But for me, what was even lacking possibly from the CCC's report is this focus on demand around food and diet. So, the agricultural sector simply reacts to demand. So if we're all eating beef burgers, you're going to see more Galloway belters or Highland cattle being looked after on the fields. So how do you is it fair to say to cap, for instance, the amount of red meat that can be cultivated by the average farm? Or do we need to look at Mr. and Mrs. Jones in Glasgow and Edinburgh and say, well, really, you need to be eating less red meat, less fish, whatever it may be. You need to educate them, then you need to support them to make that transition to lower carbon food. That seemed to be absent from the analysis I read of the manifestos. And this is in the context that in 2018, adults on average consumed in Scotland around 3 portions of fruit and veg a day. So we all know 5 is the, and that's more about health rather than carbon, but it gives you a sense of how far we've got to go. Actually 10% of adults, and this has been pretty standard over the last 15 years, 10% of adults consumed no fruit or veg on a typical day. So we've got a long way to go here, and it was absent from the manifesto. So a big surprise there and a big shame, I think.
That's really interesting. Is that more then on the kind of consumer side, so what we're consuming rather than food that's produced in Scotland, so that's a kind of consumption emissions issue rather than territorial, how we produce food here, or is it both?
Well, yeah, I think it's much of what will be accounted for here will be that the production in Scotland. So we're talking about, the traditional farming practices that we can point to. But of course, consumption of Scottish food, and we know it's an international industry, consumption of Scottish food is something that you and I probably do on a day-to-day basis. We may not even know we're doing so. So to manage these emissions, whether we're talking territorial or otherwise, this is about informing consumers about the emissions that are contained in their diet. We've heard a lot about recent kind of documentaries, Netflix, like Seaspiracy and others. What I find frustrating as a consumer is that government isn't helping me to make the right decisions. And I'm talking primarily from an education perspective. I just don't know what the right call is. And I would call myself highly informed on the subject because it is so very complex. So yes, there's a lot of work to do. And of course, the other options have got to be affordable. And I think the state can help make that the case.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be difficult to know what the right choices are because it seems that there's there's an issue with most products potentially, depending on how they're produced or where they're grown and so on. So yeah, it's a difficult one. Okay, so overall, you mentioned the Committee on Climate Change, who obviously are doing regular progress reports on where maybe we are in terms of tackling, how much progress we're making and are we making enough progress? So what's your sense of, where we are compared to where we need to be in terms of meeting our climate change goals? And I suppose where we'll be once the new Scottish Parliament gets elected later this week, given the sorts of policies that have been set out.
Yeah, so there's been a bit of recent change around this, depending on how far back you're looking. But of course, Scotland's net zero goal is legislated for. We're looking at 2045 ahead of England. That has now, sorry. So if we bring that forward to 2035 and look what the most recent carbon budget has legislated for, we're now expecting a 78% reduction on 1990 levels for greenhouse gas emissions. So we have, and you think how far away that is, it's really 14 years. We have a tremendous amount of work to do. Now, where are we today? Well, in 2018, our emissions were about 45% lower versus 1990 levels. So I guess for the uninitiated, they look at that and go, okay, that sounds doable. So the key issue is that the vast majority of those emissions and the fall of those emissions, two-thirds were related to the power sector. So many of the other sectors, which are the key contributors still today, have remained level. So, and I include agriculture in that over the last 10 years. But things like surface transport, very sticky, buildings, very sticky. Industry seen a bit of a drop, still very sticky. So we've got a lot of work to do, and I've said this many times before on our pod and others. We're now entering into kind of the second phase of this transition, and this second phase will be much more about consumers and their choices. Previously, this was something that the state and big business could have kind of got around a table and dealt with alone, and I think the power sector was a good indication of that. This was largely a reduction that was related to big utility scale projects, offshore wind primarily. Not the case with buildings when somebody's got to lag their loft, not the case with agriculture, diet when we've got to fundamentally reduce our red meat consumption, not the case with transportation when we've got to get rid of our polluting diesel estate and do away with that for an EV or a bicycle. So we have a lot of catching up to do. And actually, the Scotland missed its own annual emissions target in 2018 and was somewhat rapped on the knuckles by the CCC for doing so. The hope is, not the hope, it's probably the wrong word, but the expectation is from the CCC, the Climate Change Committee, that COVID and the associated lockdowns probably will see Scotland catch up a little bit in terms of emissions reduction, but that's demand reduction, okay, and not a decision made by people, but almost made on their behalf through lockdown. So you simply can't consume it, so you can't generate the emissions. So we have a lot to do now, and it's in largely untouched sectors, buildings, transport, and diet, I think are the three big ones we've got to consider first.
So the things still to go are the harder things to do, I suppose. Is
They're
that fair
harder
in
because
summary?
we're not economically rational beings, consumers. And I don't need to tell you and colleagues that as economists, it often, you may find the economically rational decision, and we do something radically different. And for me, there's no place less economically rational than in our own homes, or in our own cars, or where we want to travel on holiday. These are decisions made often by the heart instead of the head. And that's a challenge, I think, for regulators and policymakers, because you've got to start to understand what makes the consumer tick. And yes, cash is massive. The price has got to be right, but the price being right is not the only thing that you need in place.
Yeah, really interesting. You mentioned earlier the COP26 in Glasgow. in November, as long as it goes ahead, which we should get news on, I guess, in the next month or so. How important has that been for, I don't know, setting the scenes for the way that the policy has been talked about through this election campaign? And how important might it be for providing more impetus around climate change policies in general?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, the key to COP26 is getting international alignment around net zero and making sure it's a green recovery and a just transition. But I think nationally, the UK has been very successful in terms of targeting. It's, and I'll include Scottish government here as well, targeting where we need to go. And as I've said now, you know, we've made good progress in terms of that, but now that the hard work really, really begins. And I think what COP has done is laid down the gauntlet somewhat to policymakers to say, you've made these targets, you will come under direct scrutiny from other countries and their governments about how you expect to deliver on these. Because it's no good putting in place a target, encouraging your international peers to do the same without some shared understanding of how you're going to reach that. So the UK and Scotland is now in a precious position of being in a leadership role. We moved first, and we now have, in terms of targeting, now we have to act first. I think COP26 means that we have no excuse for taking that lead. And if we fail to act, I just see this void being filled by another. Obviously, we've seen the US government under the Biden administration starting to position themselves once again. I say once again, I think looking back to the Obama administration, but once again as a leader in this space to set the tempo for others. And hence, you know, the Paris Agreement that we saw a few years back. I don't want us to lose the momentum we have in this country, and the podium that we have later this year is, well, it's once in a lifetime, if not more important.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what happens and sort of what comes out of it. So what would you say success would look like for COP? I mean, it's a big question, obviously, but
yeah. So of course, I think following up on that point, it's about having a clear path to net zero, which has cross-party buy-in, which transcends the political cycle, policy cycle of just a few years. So, you know, if the Conservatives were to you know, no longer be in power after the next election, whether that be Labour or another, there would still be the same momentum carried on. I think that's absolutely critical. You can't do net zero without cross-party buy-in, because invariably, at some point or other, that party is going to lose power. So that's absolutely essential. For me, and I think this goes to our kind of local zero theme on our podcast, is about what it means for you and I at a local level. So I think most of us, we can look back on big events in our lives, but we can also look back on big public events that kind of set the tone in our own lives, whether it was the 2012 Olympics, whether it was when Glasgow was, you know, 1990, a city of culture. There's so many important events over the years that I think start to fire the imagination and passion of people. I really hope, and we know Glasgow has a good record of hosting big events. Commonwealth Games 2014 is another good example of this. I really think there's an opportunity here to engage people that we haven't yet done so on the green agenda, and to inform people about what needs to happen, but to empower people about thinking that they have the opportunity to act. So this is much more of a kind of cultural festival, more of a kind of COP fringe. And I hope that every village and town and city has their own roster of events during this fortnight, whether COP is happening or not in November. I think there's a real opportunity to fire up people's imagination and post-COVID bring communities together, but around the goal of net zero and a just transition.
Well, that's a very inspirational and optimistic note to end on. So thank you so much for joining us today, Matt. And
thank you.
And as Matt said, the next edition of the local Zero podcast will be published on Thursday of this week. So you'll be able to catch that. And as I said earlier, we'll put the link into the description of our podcast so you can find that and have a listen as well. So thanks for joining us for the final in our series of election podcasts. This is our 7th podcast. We're probably going to have a week or so off now before we start our next podcast series, but look out for that. As usual, you can find all of our articles on fraserofallander.org, and you can subscribe to the podcast on all major podcast platforms. So we'll see you again for the next Fraser of Allander podcast.